You are listening live to the second edition here of the Dreamcast here on thedreamshake.com. Tom Martin, your host, normally alongside Chris Nelman, but Christian is he's sick today. He might make an appearance for the guest segment, which we do have this time. But for now, just me, and the Rockets are 0-4. And I did not see that coming. I didn't see undefeated, but I did not see 0-4. I think one of the things you have to take away from this is the teams that we've played. You know, last night's 107-99 loss to New Orleans, we've never really matched up well with them. Chris Paul's always done damage against us. David West, you know, 13 points from him, that's holding him far below his standard against the Rockets. You heard Bill Worrell mention it on television. He is the Rocket killer, and we only saw 13 points from him. And you have guys like Marco Bellinelli who suddenly go off from three, and there's something about New Orleans that has always just flabbergasted the Rockets and always given them problems. And now that Paul's healthy, it just continued to happen. And you look at teams like Golden State, who are easily slowed down by a healthy Yao Ming for 35 minutes. But without Yao in there, they dictated the pace. They controlled the whole game. And, you know, predictably, it was theirs. I don't think we saw 100 and, I've forgotten the number now, whatever, 32, I think, points coming. We didn't see that. But I think that we expected perhaps to fall into that trap. And then, ironically, the best game we've played so far was against the best team in the Los Angeles Lakers. We matched up better with them. We just do. Having Shane Battier on Kobe is much easier for us to deal with than a lot of teams putting their best defender on Kobe. You take him out of the game with Shane. Even if he gets points, he does it inefficiently. And so you have to wonder how fluky this 0-4 start is. I would like to think that it is just four games, four losses that just happen to all be together at once. And that you might see the Rockets go out and, I don't know, string off five wins. Because this makes it quite clear to me that in a lot of cases, winning streaks can simply be about matchups. I mean, sure, once you get that third or fourth win, you're probably on a roll. You're probably figuring things out. But a bad matchup, some team who just happens to have the right mix of players who really makes things difficult for each of your most effective players, a matchup against one of those teams can just throw everything off. We've seen it in the past against worse teams. The 76ers have always given us problems because of their athleticism and their quickness. Other teams, you know, it's strange. I seem flabbergasted for a reason. Because, you know, this team should be so much better at this point. They really should. But then again, when you think about it, as good as a roster it is on paper, you have to give it time to develop. We've barely seen any Courtney Lee, at least in really meaningful minutes. He was great in the preseason. I thought he looked wonderful. But you throw him into the mix now, and he hasn't found his niche yet, and that's understandable. You know, he's playing much more like he did in New Jersey than he did in Orlando. He's forcing shots still. He's taking jumpers from just inside the two-point arc that don't need to be taken. And as much as I, you know, as a parent, as it is to me now, that I think the Rockets do, in fact, need, perhaps, unless this just goes away, this problem, I think the Rockets do need someone who can play outside of the offense. They need someone who, if the offense itself, the system, the free-flowing, back-cutting Edelman system, if it's not working, the Rockets have come out flat in every third quarter so far because teams have come out expecting and adjusting to that system. So I think if there's any quarter that needs to be addressed, it's not the fourth. The Rockets have had pretty good fourth quarters. It's that third quarter lull. And that's when a lot of really good players do their damage, right out of halftime. They come back, and they just take advantage of of not perhaps being as effective in the first half. The first half, as we've seen for the Rockets, has been all about the offense. The second half, it's a struggle. They've tried, but it's just been really tough. So without that really good player who can play outside the offense at this point, the Rockets have been finding it difficult to put up points. And it's funny, because points aren't really their big issue right now. They've been incredibly efficient scoring the ball, much better than last year. But it's that third quarter lull that just kills them. You know, Aaron Brooks can't do it. I think Matt made a very good point in his recap. Aaron Brooks just, at times, has not run the offense well. If Aaron Brooks gets jump shot happy as the point guard, that just takes away from the rest of the offense. Because as nice as it is to have a scoring point guard, you really don't want the scoring point guard to, oh, I don't know, especially in Aaron's case, try to do too much. Unless you have a guy like Chris Paul. Then again, I think Chris Paul makes much better decisions than Aaron Brooks does. You saw it in last night's game. Getting in the lane, drawing bigger defenders, creating matchup problems, switching matchups. You saw a couple times when Jordan Hill or Chuck Hayes, because Paul could get into the lane, they were switched onto him. And suddenly you have smaller guys in the paint. And so once you have those mismatch problems, you feed it inside, and it's an easy two. Things like that. Aaron Brooks really doesn't think that way. I don't think he does. He's shown it at times, but not consistently. It'd be nice if the Rockets had a player like that who could take a look at the pieces in front of them, both on offense and on defense, and sort them out in a way that was different than maybe he was taught by his coach. Because a coach can only do so much. They can only game plan for so much. The player, the very good players, they're able to play outside the coaching and able to make decisions on their own that can really offset the inevitable failure of coaching. I mean, look at coaching. Rick Adelman, great for out-of-bounds plays. Great for a half's worth of offense. For 10 minutes of the starters and 10 minutes of the bench guys. Or should I say 12 each. And then after that, once you have to adjust to it, it just hasn't worked out. I can't tell if that's Rick's fault or just the fault of this roster. Because when you come back into the fourth quarter, it seems like the team has suddenly rejuvenated itself. They've adjusted back. But you can't let those third quarters happen to you. You have to be able to see what the defense tries to do in those first few minutes of the third quarter and adjust quickly. Not when the third quarter has ended and when the lead that you once had is suddenly gone. And, you know, the bench looked great last night in the first half. Everything about the first half has been wonderful. I thought Lowry looked much better than he did against the Nuggets. You know that he'll just get better with more time. You look at really how this team is made up. And you look at how they are really just unable at times to find answers for their averageness. Because if one guy screws up sometimes, last night it was Luis Scola, shot 4 for 15, didn't play good defense, then it kind of kills everything. You have to wonder if having a guy like, gosh, I can't believe I'm saying this, Carmelo Anthony, or anyone like that, who can take over when other things go wrong, you have to start to wonder now that you're seeing what it's really like, that maybe that might not be such a bad thing. And for those of you who have been saying this in more emphatic terms, you know, you guys have really got a good point. I think I'm one of the few that has been a detractor of going to get Carmelo, but at this point, it might be necessary. But there's no guarantees on that front or with anyone else. I think for now, the Rockets will have to make do with what they have, and I think that, as stated, this can still be a very good team. They need to find their essence. They need to find something to get them in rhythm. The rhythm keeps falling keeps falling off at times. Once they get rolling, though, once they start to understand each other more, once Courtney Lee gets more involved, once Jordan Hill gets more involved, you saw some good things from him last night, too. Then I think, especially once they face teams that match up better against them, they'll do better. And I think it'll start this weekend against San Antonio. They say we will go. Folks, I'm privileged to announce our first guest this year, Mr. Tim Varner from 48 Minutes of Hell, the fantastic Spurs blog on the ESPN True Hoop Network. And before I get to Tim, real quick, we have Christian back with us for this segment. Christian, I understand you're a bit sick today, are you?
Yeah, not doing too well. Some kind of crud, but I expect to get over it.
Well,
and then you can hear my dulcet tones.
Yes. Well, glad to have you. But for Tim, Tim, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Well, glad to have you. And, you know, I guess with the impending matchup this weekend with the Spurs and the Rockets, I guess the one thing that I want to get to initially, because I don't watch the Spurs near as much as you do, but I have, I think, a pretty good understanding of them. And with these new big threes, with the Celtics and with the Heat, it seems like that the big three for the Spurs, with Tony Parker, Monte Ginobili, and Tim Duncan, have been somewhat overshadowed of late. How effective are these guys still compared to those big threes? How effective can these guys be?
Tony Parker, I think, is in his prime. And so on a one-to-one ratio, you know, he compares pretty well. Tim Duncan is showing some signs of age. He's had two really fantastic games this season and two kind of mediocre games. And in all the games, he's done some very good Tim Duncan-like things. He's a little slower in his rotations than he used to be. And he hobbles around a bit. He's still, you know, one of the better power forwards in the league. And I still think he has at least one more good season than him. But he's certainly on the downslope. And Ginobili is, he still looks like Manu Ginobili. One of the great things there is that he is limited in minutes. Pop has done a really good job over the years of limiting his minutes. And so for 27, 30 minutes a game, he can still essentially be an energetic freak. Now, having said that, the other teams in the league, the Celtics really have a big four, right? Probably the best True. Player on that team is Rondo at this point. And so their big three are all second bananas. And, of course, it's impossible for anyone to compare with the athletic prowess of James, Bosch, and Wade. So, certainly, I would say the Spurs' big three is kind of a second-tier core unit.
Christian?
Sure. Well, I have a couple of questions as well. I'm interested to see what you think the addition of Thiago Splitter is going to do in terms of giving Tim Duncan a little relief and in terms of the overall performance of the Spurs. I know you haven't had a chance to see him much, but I'm still interested in what you think.
Well, I watched him a lot in Europe, so I'm really familiar with his game prior to him being in San Antonio. And the thing I would say about Splitter is he reminds me a lot conceptually. So work with me here. Conceptually, he reminds me a lot of Bruce Bowen. I mean, he's a guy whose stat line, I think, will rarely make your eyes bulge out. But he does so many things well. Just in the limited minutes he's played this season, he has been a huge boost. Take last night's game, for example. In the fourth quarter, the Spurs were getting hammered. I mean, hammered in the pick and roll all game by Steve Nash. And Nash wasn't even shooting that well, but they're still getting beat. The Spurs really don't have a big who can switch on smalls and sort of recover off of a hard show. Basic things that you need in the pick and roll defense. Duncan is not able to do that like he used to. Splitter does all that stuff beautifully. And so just in that regard, he'll shore up the defense. He turned two offensive, actually three offensive fouls in last night's game. He had a couple of deflections. Little things that won't show up in the box score, but that will really have an impact on the Spurs defense. So they'll look for him to average double-double, even like a modest Marc Gasol double-double of 10 and 10. I think he's a guy who's going to play 25, 30 minutes a game. once he's in shape. And he'll give you maybe 10-7, 8-6, something in that neighborhood. But he'll also draw an offensive foul or two and get some deflections, make the right rotations on the pick and roll, and will be sort of like an invisible enforcer that doesn't show up in the box score, but nevertheless has a big impact on the game.
Well, Tim, it's funny you say that because I think the Rockets have found themselves with the same problem defending against the pick and roll. I think that's one of the reasons why they went out and got Eric Dampier. I'm not sure how Dampier and Splitter match up together, but at least Dampier is someone who can come in and provide more height and, like you said, really step up in those situations. But another player who can really step up this year, and it looks like he has so far, is Richard Jefferson. How do you think this year is different from last year for him? Because he looks much better already.
Everything's different. It's not a cliche to say that it's a night and day turnaround, 180 degrees. You know, Jefferson spent most of the summer, this is well chronicled at this point, but he spent most of the summer working with the Spurs coaching staff, most notably with Greg Popovich himself, who spent some time, several weeks in San Antonio this summer working one-on-one with Jefferson, and also with their shooting coach, Chip England. And in both cases, it's really worked out. What Jefferson is doing, he knows the system better, which helps, but he is just doing small things that are taking his game to really pre-last year levels. And for example, he is rarely catching the ball on a standstill. Last year, when he got the ball, basically he was flat-footed, he was on his heels, and he would just hold it for a minute, stare at the defender, and really not produce much of it. He's actually not the sort of athlete that breaks guys down off the dribble. For him to be effective, he needs to catch the ball as he's moving. This season, he's making those cuts, he's doing those backdoor flashes, all that sort of stuff where he catches the ball on the move and is able to finish near the hoop and, or probably even more crucially, draw fouls. He's drawing a lot of fouls a game at this point. And the fact that his shooting stroke has improved is just kind of gravy on top of all that. But he really looks like he's probably their sixth or seventh best player at this point. But, you know, as a sixth or seventh best player, he's a pretty good option.
Well, it's nice to have, and I know Christian was actually wondering the same thing here with this next guy I want to talk about, and this was James Anderson. And I like him a lot in the draft coming out of Oklahoma State, just a very good scorer. How do you think he fits in with this roster? I'm assuming he would, if you're thinking that Jefferson's your sixth or seventh best guy, how do you think Anderson compares with him right now?
Well, he's probably half the player Jefferson is right now, but he's also been a surprise. In college, he was known as a scorer, and I think the Spurs essentially drafted him because he was the best player available at 20, where they selected. He filled a need. They're sort of thin at shooting guard and small forward, and so he made sense in that regard. But the real surprising thing about him is, well, two things. One is he looks very comfortable in the court. He does not look like a rookie in the sense that he understands spacing. Last night's game in the fourth quarter, you guys may have seen Jefferson hit 4 3-pointers from the same spot in the corner over a few minutes span there in the fourth quarter. Two or three of those shots, I'd have to go back and look at it, were assisted by James Anderson. The first one especially was a very smart, wasn't a fantastic highlight reel pass, but it was a great pass in terms of basketball IQ and recognition of what was going on the floor. And it was a cross-court pass from essentially, you know, one corner to the other. Really nice pass. And it's the sort of thing that rookies would miss. They just don't have the court vision for that. And so he's been a real pleasant surprise. And in addition to all that, he's knocking down three-pointers, and of course the Spurs love to shoot the three ball. And more importantly, he's defending. You know, competent to maybe slightly above-average defender 4 games into the NBA. And so I have a lot of high hopes that he could become, no one's going to become Bruce Bowen, but he could become a reliable guy that Spurs pull off the bench to cool down a hot game.
Well, interesting. You know, we don't have a whole lot of time here, so we'll get to this last question. In general, how do you think the Spurs match up with this Houston team, and who do you think comes out on top?
Well, it's a difficult question. This Houston team, I've watched two Rocket games this year, and I'm not sure which team I'm watching.
We're the same way.
Much better team than they're playing. Much, much better team, you know, on paper. And I'm not really sure what to, you know, attribute their losses to other than, really, I don't know. It kind of just boggles my mind. I think on paper that the, you know, 4, 5, 6 seed in the West.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a little bit weird so far. I think the Spurs match up fairly well. I think Houston gives us some problems at two guard. You have a lot of speed, and you have some athletes that we have a hard time matching up with. Your backcourt speed is especially problematic at points. Parker and Ginobili are both good defenders, but they're not excellent, and they're a little bit slow laterally. And then, of course, your size up front is a big problem. Dwan Blair, who's wonderful in many ways, is still only 6'7", and people say, well, you don't shoot the top of your head. He has great reach and all that. At the end of the day, it's hard for him to defend guys who are taller, and it's easy to bother his shot more. So, you know, you guys, I think, really neutralized our fifth or sixth best player in a vital bench / you know, energy starter.
Uh-huh.
And so by taking him out of the game, it gives San Antonio problems. I like your team probably as much as I like the Spurs roster for the season. And for tomorrow night, you know, I think Houston Vitali is on the board at some point here, right?
I hope so.
We certainly hope so, yes.
Christian, what are you thinking about tomorrow night? Or Saturday?
I think the Rockets finally break out of this against their old rival, the Spurs. But who knows? The season is flabbergasted me in certain ways, but I think we're going to break out.
Well, I think so too, and I think a big factor of it, and this has always been prevalent in the past, at least to me, was just keeping Tony Parker out of the paint, either with him getting in there scoring or making plays on guys on the outside, and it appears with Jefferson fighting that stroke, and with Anderson now, and with just Ginobili healthy, that if Parker gets inside and either him scoring or him kicking out, you have more dangerous options on the perimeter now. So if the Rockets can finally find a way to shut down that paint, even the slightest bit, I think, you know, it'll really contribute greatly. But it could go either way. We've seen two different Rockets teams, like you said, Tim, and you know, all of us are here are hoping it works out in our favor. So we thank you for coming on, and hope you have a good time watching the game.
Okay, thanks, guys. Great vlog, by the way. I reach you guys often at the end. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. All right, take care. We'll come back after this. Listeners, stay tuned. That was Tim Barner from 48 Minutes of Hell, the fantastic San Antonio Spurs blog for ESPN True Hoop. And I guess now we're going to talk about some general NBA stuff going on. I guess one thing you pointed out to me earlier, Christian, before we started doing this, was the fact that of all the teams, maybe aside from one, unless I just missed something, that the Rockets have come the closest to defeating the 5-0 Lakers, which I think is pretty interesting, just given how, like Tim said earlier, how up and down we can be. I mean, what does that say about our team?
Well, it says to me that we're the only team that had a shot at beating them. You know, we were down 2 points with a chance to tie or win in a closing play. Nobody's come close to that with the Lakers since then. Everyone else, the only team that really seemed to be, Sacramento was in the game for a couple quarters and then got overwhelmed, basically. And the same thing with Phoenix. They destroyed Memphis. And Memphis was a team that played pretty well last year, and
yeah.
Memphis wasn't in that game from the start. So that I've seen, I've seen all those games, and so the only one to me that looks, the only team that's played the Lakers close has been the Rockets, really. So that's an interesting thing. Here are the Lakers at 5-0, the Rockets at 0-4, and I still think we can beat them. So that's maybe a hopeful sign for the Rockets.
Well, I wonder how much of that had to do with Shane Battier matching up with Kobe Bryant, because as we've said before, Battier is not great at keeping up with those smaller, quicker guards, but without Bryant, and Bryant, for the points he had in that game, was pretty much taken out of it. It was a lot more of Pau Gasol, and then, of course, Steve Blake and Shannon Brown taking over at the end. But another great team, obviously. We've seen them after that first initial loss. They've bounced back admirably, the Miami Heat. And then the interesting part is when you think about all the guys they got, they re-sign Wade, they trade for James and get Bosch. It's the defense that has suddenly become, as John Hollinger pointed out, historically great. You know, is this a defensive team first to you, or is this just going to be a, you know, for whatever happens on any given night? Like, you can tell by how much I'm trying to think here how mind-boggling this roster is.
Well, it's pretty amazing. I mean, right now through five games, they're giving up 84 points a game.
Incredible.
They've got the biggest differential in the league at almost 17 points. That's astonishing. And that's maybe the dominance people were expecting. And, you know, so they lost their opener. Now they've won 4 out of 5. Are they going to win 80% of their games? They might. If they play defense like that, they might. I thought Orlando was going to give them a big game, and Orlando was never really in it. It was not a close game at all.
Uh-huh. Well, what do you think, speaking of high-flying athletes like James or Wade, should I say, John Wall, great game against the Philadelphia 76ers the other night, 29 points, 13 assists, I believe, and 9 steals? It was
nine
close
steals,
to a triple-double.
Triple-double the hard way, right?
Yeah, and the interesting thing, though, is those 8 turnovers, and we saw it in the summer league, in the preseason. A lot of point guards who are playmakers, should we say. If you want to call Steve Nash a playmaker, for example, he's always been turnover prone too. Do you think this is something that Wall can get over eventually?
Absolutely. He's a rookie. He's gonna be turnover prone. He's gonna have some problems, but I think in the end that he'll get it sorted. This is a rookie just starting out in the league, trying to, and not just a rookie, a young rookie. Remember, he played 1 year of college ball, so that's how young he is to be handed the keys to a franchise, basically. I think the start is very, very promising for Wall, and I'm not sure I've ever seen a player who's more effective at speed than Wall. It's pretty unbelievable.
Well, it's interesting because when you think of all the assets or attributes that Aaron Brooks has with his speed and with his quickness getting around players, you suddenly add about 5 or 6 more inches to that with John Wall, a 6'4" player, and I'm not convinced that Aaron Brooks is 6 foot. He's 5'10" on a good day. Do what?
Everybody's 6 feet. Nobody can.
Well, it's going to be interesting, though, because I think a lot of people detracted him for some reason. I think everyone jumped on the John Wall bandwagon, and then people started kind of second-guessing themselves. But I don't see a reason for that. He's going to be a great player. So I'm looking forward to that. And at the same time, like you said, you have to kind of keep perspective on this. We saw Brandon Jennings last year drop 50-plus points in a game and then really level off. But again, he's only entering his second year in the league, and Wall is a rookie as well. So with a lot of these different guys, you'll see spurts of greatness, and then as they get better over time, it'll likely level off into more consistent play. So that's all we have today.
This way, just real quick.
Sure.
This is a guy who's 7 years away from his peak, and this is what he's doing. It's sort of like, sort of how I think of Durant. It's like, this is what Durant's doing at 21. Wall's doing this at, what is he, 19, 20?
Something like that.
And this is what he's doing then. You know, what's he going to be like at 26, 27? So that's something to look forward to, I think.
To counter that briefly, and we'll keep you here for a second, listeners, with, you know, speaking of Durant, I want to get back to LeBron James a bit. For one second, I think when we first saw LeBron in his rookie season, decent numbers, kind of like what we might expect Wall to do, albeit differently. But LeBron played well, but we saw plenty of weaknesses, and then he consistently got better over the next, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. But after that point, he probably leveled off just a bit, you know? And he really hasn't, I haven't seen LeBron James improve much in the past 3 or 4 years. Do you think he can keep improving? And do you think that Kevin Durant can really improve on, if he goes for 30 a game this year, can you really improve on that?
Okay, well, just briefly, LeBron, I think LeBron can improve. He's sort of plateaued, and the thing is, it's a bit hard to see because the level is so high. I mean, the fact is, you know, by most, any statistical measure, LeBron James is the best player in the NBA.
Yes.
And it's not particularly close. And I love Durant, so that's not to belittle him in any way. But there's still things that, as an observer, you could see LeBron James adding to his game and becoming a more effective player, which is sort of scary. You could see LeBron, he's never really posted up. He could add a post-up game. He could stop taking so many threes when he feels a little tired. He may do that in Miami now that he's got someone to that he can absolutely trust to hand the ball off to in Wade. And the fact is, with Miami, you're always getting one of those guys. But anyway, that's another matter. Going back to Durant, Durant could score 34 a game. He really could.
Really?
I think it's out there. There's nobody's come up with a good way of stopping him. Well, Ron Artest put a body on him and slowed him down, but he's going to get past that too, I think. We'll see. There are things that Durant can certainly do to improve his game. He can become a better defender. He can probably distribute the ball even more. So there's places for him to go in terms of growth in his game. One of which is just eliminating mistakes. And a largely mistake free Kevin Durant is a terrifying prospect, I think.
Well, interesting. I don't know. It's funny because if you think he can really hit 34, and then there's some people outside me, so we have interference. This is not the first class podcast we claim it to be, apparently. But you know, I don't know.
Headquarters.
Well, you don't know though, because if you want Durant to distribute the ball more, and with the players around him, because I think OKC has a very good roster around him. I think if Durant was in the situation that Kobe Bryant was in a few years back, he could easily score 34, 35. But at some point, when you have better players around you, you'd like to distribute more. I think LeBron could score a lot more as well. But even in Cleveland, you know, as much as that roster got killed by the press, it wasn't that bad. And now here in Miami, it's great. So I think scoring only does so much, and I think certain players, for the benefit of the team, will probably level off that scoring. You've seen Kobe come back down to the 29, 28 range. So, interesting. But
that's a fair point. I mean, there's probably an upper level of scoring for an unselfish player like Durant, and probably it's around 32 points a game. You're probably right.
Yeah. Well,
and after that, he's going to want to pass. He's going to feel like he's just consuming too many shots. Except you look at the OKC roster, and even though it's good, there's almost no situation in which Durant consuming a shot isn't the best thing to do.
That's true.
But I think he's too unselfish to do that. I don't think he's not a me first player at all, and I think that there probably is an upper limit to what a guy who's as unselfish as he is will do in terms of scoring.
Absolutely. Well, listeners, we will leave you here. We're continuing to work on our craft, but hope you enjoyed it this time. We'll be back next week, hopefully with a new guest. So for Christian Edelman, I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening.